Does it matter? No, because rich people can secure their own interests, right? No one is weeping for the slurs against rich people because it doesn't matter, right? And that's what we need to do. We need to make marginalized people no longer marginalized. And I would prefer to have a conversation about how to actually achieve that rather than fixating on some person with a bad haircut getting punched in the
right.
face because it doesn't matter.
But you're basically, so you're actually agreeing with what I'm saying, because my point is that we fixate on the Nazi punching and we see that as the work that we're doing, right?
Right.
Instead of the more concrete class-based, power-based work. So, oh my God, I can't believe that we're going to end on a note of agreement. Do you feel weird? Does that make you feel uncomfortable?
Yeah, it makes you feel great.
Wow. All right. This is a special moment. So, guys, thank you so much. We're going to wrap up definitely the radio portion. Do we have and then we're going to, so radio listeners, thank you for listening to the Katie Halper Show. Thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you for participating, Angela Nagel. Freddie, what are you on Twitter?
Yeah, it's like Ange Nagel.
Ange Nagel on Twitter. Freddie DeBoer on Twitter. Freddie DeBoer, yeah. Gabe Pacheco, which is Gabe underscore Pacheco on Twitter. And then I'm, yeah. And of course, the hashtag KT Helps Show, and I'm KT Helps on Twitter. And don't go anywhere, because we are going to do a free speech themed comedy show. You can go somewhere, which is to the bar. But we have like a 5 minute, we're going to take a 5 minute break and then transition into the next phase. So thank you guys again so much. And make sure you go to like us on Facebook and on iTunes, rate and review us. And thanks again. And guys, remember, after the comedy, it's karaoke.
Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Hi, this is Virginia White of Earth, Wind & Fire, and you're listening to The Sweet Spot on WBAI.
Thursday, June 15th at 10 p.m., Baby K from The Sweet Spot teams up with DJ Spinna in a tribute to the mighty force of musical ascension known as Earth, Wind, and Fire. We'll be featuring an interview we did with bassist Verdine White and also chopping it up with Spinna as he plays some of his favorite Earth, Wind, and Fire tracks. That's The Sweet Spot, Thursday, June 15th at 10 p.m., only on WBAI 99.5 FM, listener-sponsored community radio.
Hi, I'm Ken Gale. On Tuesday, June 20th, my guest on EcoLogic will be meteorologist Tom Weissmuller, who will predict this summer's weather and hurricane season and explain how El Niños and La Niñas in the Western Pacific Ocean and storms in the Western Sahara Desert will affect our weather. That's Tuesday, June 20th at 8 p.m. here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
Thank you, Ken. And you are listening to WBAI. The time is just after 8 p.m. on a Wednesday evening. That means it's time for Off the Hook. And as soon as I find our theme, there's all kinds of interesting things going on this board. Let's give this a try.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse.
I do so love our theme. It doesn't feel like the show without it. Yes, the program is Off the Hook. This is Rob T. Firefly here with you, and I am joined in the studio by Voltaire.
Good evening.
And by Alex.
Hello.
Emmanuel and Kyle are not here. They're not here, so we can get away with anything. Where they are is an assignment, pretty much all over Europe. They're doing all kinds of exciting things. If you listen to Off the Wall, their other program, you can get the more regular updates on that. Most recently, they did an interview on Italy's Radio Popolare, which was quite good. Even if you don't understand Italian, there's some good stuff going on. But they have upcoming stops, which you might like to know about. They're going to be in London. They're going to be in Edinburgh, Scotland. They're going to be in Reykjavik. And if you're a listener and you're in any of those places and you'd like to maybe say hi or see what's what, get in touch with us, oth@2600.com. Very exciting things going on out there in the world. So, it's just us. The substitute teacher is in charge. There are no rules. You don't have to have your homework done.
We did all pledge loyalty, though.
Of course we pledge loyalty. I mean, this wouldn't be a proper radio show if we didn't take care of that. I mean, that little formality. There's a lot of stuff that's going on, stuff to talk about. Some stories going on. Maybe a story or two involving this guy. What does he do? He's the president of America. This guy Trump, who it turns out is maybe under some kind of investigation. But leading to that, there have been some interesting updates on things we talked about last week involving the Russian threats on the U.S. electoral system. The possibility that that this was Russia, the leaks that released this information by someone called Reality Winner to The Intercept, mm-hmm. The fact that The Intercept kind of dropped the ball when it came to protecting their sources, all kinds of interesting stuff going on.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot there to unpack, isn't there? I mean, it's been quite an exciting week, and I think right before we came on the air, I received an alert from CNN that stated that President Trump was, in fact, under investigation for obstruction of justice by Special Counsel Robert Mueller. That's quite interesting, but also not really surprising, because if Mueller did not investigate that, there would be very serious questions about the legitimacy of what he did investigate. So it's breaking news, but also not really all that surprising, but nonetheless, good to hear. Good to hear they're doing their job. You know, on that subject, though, another story that has been touted by various mainstream media over the last couple of weeks has been the legal team that Robert Mueller has been assembling. And he really has been assembling, you know, quite fine legal minds from Washington, D.C., a lot of old hands from Washington, D.C. And what I'm a little bit concerned about as a lawyer is that, and this could, I guess, come off as a bit ageist, although I don't really intend it to be, but a lot of these guys don't necessarily seem to have a great understanding of technology, which is where people like we come in. And I'm afraid that when we're talking about communications and we're talking about data and metadata and the flow of information across borders and an investigation into the legitimacy of the arguably greatest nation's electoral system in 2016 that resulted in this morass that we have in the White House now, and that was two words, actually. It could have been one, but yeah. In any event, I feel like they may be missing some technological expertise on that particular team. I mean, what do you guys think about that?
I certainly agree. We also talked about Comey in the news recently, and like as much as people want to see him as a friend, because he's testifying against Trump, I think it's important to recognize him as instead just an enemy of one's enemy, but not necessarily a friend. And the perfect example is this: is he's even as recently as yesterday, he according to Detector, he called again for a quote unquote compromise in the crypto war 2.0, where he says that like, oh, we have to quote unquote, or he had to like nerd harder and find some quote unquote compromise where we can put a backdoor that only the Americans can use in cryptography. And like anybody that knows the basics about technology and information security knows that it's impossible to have a backdoor that only one party understands. And we saw that with where even the NSA wasn't able to keep their stuff secure. So like what chances are there that if we put a backdoor in communication that only the Americans will be able to use it? And here we have Comey wanting to basically – he calls it a compromise, but it's just a way to ban everything that's not fully encrypted.
Yeah, pretty much everything the FBI has done, you know, for the past however many administrations that that aggravated the hacker community. It's important to remember that this guy was the boss of them.
Yeah. Well, that's true. That is true. I mean, I do think, though, that when he testified last week, it came across as very candid. And I think, for the most part, sincere, in stark contrast to Attorney General Sessions' testimony yesterday. But, to get back to this Russia and hacking thing, one thing that's very interesting to me is that we all seem to have, very short memories these days. And there's been so much happening, it's hard to place it all in context. But, we learned very recently that the Russian hacking activities, they weren't necessarily really attempts. These were actually completed actions, and I think 37 states had indicated, or perhaps 37 states, something around that number, had indicated that they had found evidence relating to Russian actors in their systems, whether it was state voting databases, whether it was election-related software, things of that nature. There's been a huge amount of information that's come out, and other information that's come out as well indicates that the Obama administration knew about this as early as the summer of 2016 and was extremely concerned about it in October of 2016. Now, rewind our memories back to the immediate aftermath of the election. And when everyone woke up one day and realized that there was somebody called President-elect Trump and we didn't know what to do, so there were a lot of efforts for recounts. And Jill Stein... excuse me, Jill Stein was one of the main proponents of these recount lawsuits. And they all pretty much failed. And in large part because either she was found to not have standing to contest the election. And that's a point I do want to go back to. So maybe I should have made it second. But first of all, she was found to not have standing to come into federal court and demand a recount because she didn't command a significant portion of the vote in the United States. And secondarily, no recount or no forensic examination could be ordered because there was no evidence of tampering in the elections. Nobody could produce to a federal court any evidence that there was any tampering. Yet now we know that evidence of tampering was in fact in the possession of the administration, and they were in fact really concerned about it.
I'm just going to push back on you because the revelations that have come out, there's been no actual evidence of tampering. What we've seen is penetration into voting rolls and voting systems where basically like finding out how it works, which is pretty common for intelligence agencies. But there's been no documented case of voter tampering. And I think if that had come out, we would have seen it leaked by now because it's so explosive and that the intelligence community isn't exactly good friends with Trump and they might want to leak that to undermine him if that was the case.
Well, I totally agree with you there, Voltaire. That, but I think it all depends on what you define as tampering, right? And an intrusion into these state registration databases, I guess, arguably could be considered tampering. It might if that information was in the possession of Jill Stein and produced to the panel of federal judges that was deciding this, it may have, in fact, tipped the scales, though, for them to at least order some kind of forensic examination of these particular systems, because what they were faced with was a chicken and egg type of scenario where, in order for them to order some sort of forensic examination, they needed some form of evidence of tampering or some indicia that some foreign actor was meddling. And this, I think, could have been that tipping point. If we had that information come out into the public sphere in the immediate aftermath of the election, those recount lawsuits may have been decided differently. And to go back to the other point, and I think this will be somewhat unpopular on this particular station, but the standing issue is something that always bothered me about these Jill Stein recount lawsuits as well. And that's because these were federal lawsuits, and under the federal rules of civil procedure, there is a particular rule that says if you don't have standing, if you're not the real party in interest in a lawsuit, then you can substitute the real party in interest. And who was the real party in interest? The real party in interest was Hillary Clinton. But she didn't stand up. She didn't. She could have come in to federal court and made a motion to intervene in that case as the real party in interest and said, yes, please recount these votes or order a forensic examination because I think something has been askew with these particular results. But she didn't do that. And I think that we are remiss if we don't comment on it in this context as well. And I don't think really anybody has. So, I think there's a lot to be said with respect to the Russian hacking revelations lately and with respect to The Intercept, as you mentioned, there's a lot of controversy there too, because they have pushed back on the notion that they did not properly protect sources and methods when they released the particular memorandum allegedly provided by Reality Winner, I believe is the name. Is that right, Rob?
Yeah, Reality Lee Winner, I think, is the name of the person who's been taken into custody. And we did have an email from a listener last week, someone called Julio, who wrote, you guys haven't even looked to The Intercept and you're just parroting the government dealt narrative. This is when we were criticizing The Intercept for kind of dropping the ball and protecting their source. And Julio asks, why are we criticizing The Intercept if we haven't even asked them what the heck happened? You should at least mention that what you guys said is the government narrative. That's actually absolutely critical to that discussion. Well, there was really nothing available beyond The Intercept posted the following statement on June 6th, which was the day after they published their story involving the leaks. Their statement reads, on June 5th, The Intercept published a story about a top-secret NSA document that was provided us completely anonymously. Shortly after the article was posted, the Justice Department announced the arrest of Reality Lee Winner, a 25-year-old government contractor in Augusta, Georgia, so on and so on. While the FBI's allegations against Winner have been made public through the release of an affidavit and search warrant, which were unsealed at the government's request, it is important to keep in mind that these documents contain unproven assertions and speculation designed to serve the government's agenda and as such warrant skepticism. Winner faces allegations that have not been proven. The same is true of the FBI's claims about how it came to arrest Winner. And they go on to say they'll make no further comment on the running investigation. But a blog called Errata Security that day posted with very illustrative images the invisible dots, basically, the micro dots that were in the leaked documents, which The Intercept posted, which can be traced right back to not only the individual printer they were printed from, but when it was printed. And if you work in a government facility, and you know where the printer is that was used, you know when it was used, you can pretty much follow that lead into who was using the printer at the time. And so it's really kind of I think easy to see Voltaire.
Yeah, it's kind of disappointing to see the Intercept not own up to their mistakes. I mean, I still maintain that Reality would have been found out either if they hadn't released the micro dot printed evidence. But it's still upsetting that they were being defensive about it.
Yeah, I completely agree. And in the interest of full disclosure, I have written for The Intercept in the past. My name's on their website. You can look it up, but. I think all the facts need to come out, and we have to also remember that, you know, the mission of journalistic organizations is very, very similar to the mission of intelligence agencies in a lot of respects. They're there to collect information, and they need to protect their sources and their methods. And in this particular scenario, the release of that information that contained the microdots appears to have been an oversight, regardless of whether or not it actually led to the capture of Reality Winner, or led to critical evidence that indicated that Reality Winner was, in fact, the person who had printed this document. And so, you know, they're performing some form of internal investigation at the time, at this time, and they claim to try to be as transparent as possible with the results of whatever this internal investigation is going to be. And a lot of criticism has been heaped upon the one of the security researchers and analysts over at The Intercept, I think Michael Lee, about their inability to protect sources in this particular story. But apparently what The Intercept has come out and said is that Michael Lee and others upon whom lots of criticism have been heaped didn't actually have any interaction with the story whatsoever. But then that, frankly, raises another question, which is, why didn't they? If these people were there to help protect sources and methods, then this is a really important story whose sources really deserve protection. And before anybody divulges anything over to a federal agency, they should have input as to what should be divulged. If a photo, I mean, this could have possibly been very easily manipulated, and the content could have been given to the FBI or to DOJ or whoever requested it without the provision of the microdots. You could redact the document, you could crop it, you could take a picture of it and then reprint it. There's lots of different things that you could do that could have protected this information from being disclosed. So, you know, I think The Intercept finds itself in a sticky situation right now. I think for the most part, they're a pretty fantastic organization. They do a lot of great reporting, but that doesn't mean that they're beyond reproach and beyond criticism.
Quite so. And talking of these microdots, just to explain them for the listeners, they are dots that are printed on the document that are not on the document you're printing. The printer adds them. They are just barely invisible to the human eye because they're small and done in yellow ink. But when you scan an image, when you use image editing software to further analyze it, you can find these patterns of dots, which are basically a dot matrix sort of code, which would work similar to maybe a barcode or things like that. So erratasec.com, erratasec.com, is the site with a really interesting blog post, which not only explains this, but also goes into ways that this not only this source could have been protected, but that you can protect yourself if you're doing something that involves printing off copies of things. Things like printing it on a black and white printer, which doesn't have the yellow ink, or printing it and then making a copy of it, a photocopy or something. Just all these different things to consider when you're engaging in stuff like this.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. But and again, I maintain a position. I think that the protection of sources and methods is so incredibly important to journalists, and these organizations are really under fire. That, you know, this raises larger issues for other journalistic organizations as well, and that it is so incredibly important for them to be able to protect sources and methods. You know, one of the news organizations that I've done a good amount of work with in the past is BRIC. Here in Brooklyn, as a matter of fact. In fact, we actually talked a lot about the Russian hacking or the potential for Russian hacking when I debated the executive director of the New York City Board of Elections prior to the election. And then they had me on back at BRIC because some of the things I said, unfortunately, had rang true, and now even truer. But for a small organization like BRIC that's here in Brooklyn, you know, this is something that, you know, is extremely important to them. And unfortunately, I think a lot of larger organizations are really overlooking these types of protections and how easy it is to unmask the identity of somebody.
Just for those unfamiliar, BRIC is the public access television station here in Brooklyn. That's spelled BRIC, I believe.
That is absolutely correct.
Excellent. Moving on to other stuff going on in the world. This is a story that I wanted to just spend a short minute on because it's fun, and we need some more of those. This past Saturday, the world had to say goodbye, sadly, to Adam West, who was the actor who played Batman in the 1960s. He played the mayor of Quahog and Family Guy and all sorts of other things. Basically, a great comic talent, in my opinion. But he was also a bit of a comedian in his own life. There's a post on Boing Boing written by Rusty Blazenhoff, which goes into how Adam West hid a little prank in his local telephone book. Remember telephone books? Rusty writes, "A few years back, I was in Sun Valley, Idaho for a conference. I learned Adam West lived in the area, and I wondered if he was listed in the phone book. So I pulled it out of the nightstand in my hotel room and checked. Flipping to the W page, I spotted his name. His listing prompted," this is under West Adam, "his listing prompted C. Wayne Bruce, millionaire." Which, you know, that's pretty great to just on its own. But then when Rusty flipped to Wayne Bruce Millionaire, under there it said, "Please consult crime fighters in the yellow pages." So moving on to the yellow pages, looking up crime fighters, under the category of crime fighters, it says, "See Batman, white pages." And if you're following along, this is pretty great. Under, you go back to the white pages, and you look up Batman, and it says, "See West Adam." So... well played, Mr. West. Well played.
Interesting. Interesting. I mean, I do remember phone books. You know, they're still often distributed to me. And it's amazing when you walk around Manhattan after phone books are distributed. Actually, mm-hmm. I haven't seen them recently, so maybe they aren't distributed regularly anymore.
They still are. in multiple buildings in which I've lived, they basically drop a huge pile of phone books in the front lobby of a building, and it's up to you whether to take one or whether to wait for them to just start absorbing ambient moisture and turn into mush. But there's really I think a dwindling market, but they do keep delivering phone books everywhere in the country, because the companies that make the phone books have fought for this right for it to continue happening. They call it a free speech issue because, of course, they make their money by charging people for ads, the sorts of people who still pay to put ads in phone books. Voltaire.
I was just going to say that. I think my hunch is the same reason, that it's just the advertising revenue that they're getting. And I bet just like AOL makes a lot of its money from people that have auto-renewing old AOL dial-up accounts. The same thing with these advertising. They don't even... small businesses don't even realize they're being charged monthly for these advertisements.
Absolutely, and people don't know that they have other internet service which they use, and they don't actually need the AOL subscription anymore. It's an interesting sort of conundrum. I used to make paper mache out of the phone book pages because you know, there was a ready supply of very cheap and squishy paper.
Did you ever make a paper mache blue box out of that?
Unfortunately, not. I couldn't get the right frequency paper crystal, but I'll work on that. But yeah, so they're a thing that might keep happening where you are. It might just make for, you know, a nice little break in your day. You pick up your phone book that's been delivered, and you have to take the walk over to the recycling bin to drop it again. And you know, maybe along the way you see some sights or something. I don't know.
I have a friend. Excuse me, that I grew up with, who used a phone book in an interesting way. It was somewhat psychological, actually. It was a sort of psychological balancing tool, in that no matter what went wrong in his life, he felt like he could steady himself by looking up one particular name in the phone book. And if that name was still in the phone book, it somehow made him feel okay. And this person's name, and it was out on Long Island, was Barry Barracuda. That if there was somebody, if that name was still in the white pages, you know, no matter what was going on in his life, it's sort of like saying, you know, no matter what happens, you can always break a plate with a hammer. Barry Barracuda was always still in the white pages. And I wonder if he still is.
Man, well, Mr. Barracuda, if you're listening, get in touch with us, oth@2600.com. But yeah, if you know, there's the old gag in the Steve Martin film, The Jerk. He found his name in the phone book and realized that he had become somebody because his name was in print. This used to mean something back in the days when people still used phone numbers, let alone you know, needed to look them up. Nowadays, you just flip to whoever it is in your phone book, and you're done with it. But before I chase all the rapscallion kids off my lawn, due to being terribly, terribly old, we can talk about something else that's going on with the UK. Our friends in the UK have a whole lot going on this week. One of the many things is Theresa May, the Prime Minister, whose party, the Conservative campaign, lost pretty big in the most recent election that they had. She has decided to go on with her plan, which we spoke about a little on the previous weeks in this on this program, to launch wide-ranging internet regulation and security changes. Basically, she wants to have a tighter grip on the internet. Story from The Independent in the UK says that in the speech in which she committed to keep governing despite calls to stand down, the Prime Minister made reference to extending powers for the security services, those powers which include regulation of the internet and forcing internet companies to let spies read everyone's private communications, were a key part of the Conservative campaign, which failed to score a majority in the House of Commons. So her party's been told no, but she's still banging on with this. There was a statement that came out of Number 10 Downing Street, which is their seat of government, in which the UK and France announce a joint campaign to, as they put it, tackle online radicalization. Ahead of the Prime Minister's visit to Paris today, this comes from Number 10, where she'll hold talks on counterterrorism with French President Emmanuel Macron, the UK and France have announced a new joint campaign to ensure that the internet cannot be used as a safe space for terrorists and criminals. This posted the 13th, yesterday. Crucially, plans include exploring the possibility of creating a new legal liability for tech companies if they fail to remove content. That's a bit onerous. This could, for example, include penalties such as fines for companies that fail to take action. The two countries will lead joint work with the tech companies on this vital agenda, including working with them to develop tools to identify and remove harmful material automatically. So, you know, the UK and France want to be able to just take things off the internet, because we all know how easy it is to take things off the internet. This quotes Theresa May herself as saying, "The counterterrorism cooperation between British and French intelligence agencies is already strong, but President Macron and I agree that more should be done to tackle the terrorist threat online. In the UK, we're already working with social media companies to halt the spread of extremist material and poisonous propaganda that is warping young minds. And today I can announce that the UK and France will work together to encourage corporations to do more and abide by their social responsibility to step up their efforts to remove harmful content from their networks, including exploring the possibility of creating a new legal liability for tech companies if they fail to remove unacceptable content. We are united in our total condemnation of terrorism and our commitment to stamp out this evil."
I think this is problematic for two aspects. The obvious aspect is the censorship one, and like, who's to say what counts as extremist content. And the other is a less obvious one is the issue of monopolization, where the only, like, by making sites liable for user submitted content, it's going to restrict the sites. Will they'll only be able to create new sites that are able to afford to have all these censors to pay them, and that will make less independent sites that create independent content.
I mean, I completely agree with you, and I think another problem with it, I mean, well, there are so many problems with this. I mean, it's very difficult to figure out where to start, but I think I'll just build on Voltaire's comments. It's the most logical thing to do, but it really creates a problem for companies in this way, because when you're let's say, if you're not Google or Facebook and you're a smaller company, you're faced with daunting regulatory regimes, and we help companies deal with regulation all across the globe. And part of what you need to do when you're allocating your resources is figure out, you know, with which rules am I going to comply? And if you don't have the resources to have different sets of operations in every single jurisdiction, you tend to go with the most restrictive type of regulatory regime that you can think of. In the United States, you know, when it came to privacy laws, that was for a very long time Massachusetts. So everybody took Massachusetts's privacy laws as the gold standard with which they had to comply, and any other state's laws, they were on the books, but they weren't really as strict as Massachusetts. This is going to happen internationally, especially when it comes to the creation of content and user-submitted content. So if we are going to regulate to the lowest common denominator, which happens to be, well, or rather will be, the United Kingdom, that becomes a real problem for everybody else. And then secondarily, what Theresa May is implicitly stating here, aside from the freedom of expression issue, which Voltaire, I think, very rightly pointed out, is that these expressions of terrorist propaganda are somehow effective and somehow perhaps valid or able to radicalize people rather easily. So what she's saying there is that the citizens of the UK are susceptible to this essentially because they're weak-minded and we can't trust them. They're going to be convinced by this kind of thing, or rather they shouldn't be offended by it. And if they are offended by it, then there's another problem that we have with this particular set of proposed regulations, which is the very point of free speech is to be confronted with different viewpoints, not necessarily just the viewpoint of the United Kingdom or the United States of America that oppose terrorism. We should be presented with opposing viewpoints. In fact, if you look at the history of case law in the United States that is protective of the First Amendment, it's all about the clash of ideas. And if we believe that our ideas are valid and stronger and should be believed over this offensive terrorist propaganda, then we shouldn't really have to worry about it unless we believe, as I said before, that we're so weak-minded and unable to think for ourselves that this is going to have some kind of deleterious effect across the entire nation. And I think that's frankly ridiculous.
Yeah, very true. There is a group, if you're familiar with the Electronic Frontier Foundation and the important work they do here in the United States, over in the UK they have a group called the Open Rights Group, which is sort of along the same lines. It's an organization of technically educated individuals who are trying to fight bad regulations and that sort of thing. And they posted a response on their site, openrightsgroup.org, to the post from number 10. And among other things, They say that the UK and France would work with tech companies to develop tools to identify and remove harmful material automatically, quoting the original post. May and Macron's proposal is to identify and remove new extremist content. It is unclear whose rules, as you said, they want internet companies to enforce. They go on to say, context is king when it comes to judging content. Will these automated systems really be able to tell the difference between posts that criticize terrorism while using video of terrorists and posts promoting terrorism that use the same video? Questions abound. What incentives will the companies have to get it right? Will there be any safeguards? If so, how transparent will those safeguards be? Will the companies be fined for censoring legal content as well as failing to censor illegal content? And what about the global picture? Internet companies like Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube have a global reach. Will they be expected to create a system that can be used by any national government, even those with poor human rights records? I mean, certainly there are things that we all do on the internet that in certain countries in the world would be illegal, or at least very dodgy, or at least get you looked at. And will they be expected to create... Well, they go on to say, it's unclear whether May and Macron have thought through whether they are happy for internet platforms to become an arm of every state they operate in. Now, when we think about the internet, which operates in pretty much every state that that has access, I mean, this is pretty wide-ranging. Voltaire.
I think what's interesting is that they've taken something out of China's playbook, where on sites like Sina Weibo and WeChat, they don't actually... the censorship isn't actually done by the Chinese government. The Chinese government has just mandates the, or basically deputizes these companies to regulate it, and doesn't give them clear guidelines of what's illegal and what's not. And that causes them to overregulate it beyond what the Chinese government says. And then if people criticize the government for censorship, they say, oh, it's a company decision. And that's the same playbook that May and Macron seem to be doing here, which is outsourcing to the tech companies to say, oh, you decide what's too extremist. And then in that case, they're going to regulate way more than the government would.
And Alex, you operated in the UK for a bit in the legal sphere. I mean, mm-hmm. what based on your experiences and such, what do you feel about the chances of something like this?
I think they're pretty good. You know, think back to the Investigatory Powers Act that actually, you know, became law in the United Kingdom. And, you know, if that became law, I mean, it was also known as the Snooper's Charter, then I think these particular proposed regulations do have a good chance. And, you know, the one thing that the British are very good at doing is using the English language. And, I mean, it is called English, after all. It's theirs. And the way in which Theresa May phrases her arguments, they become very, very difficult to argue with, because, you know, who's really opposed to stamping out terrorist propaganda on the internet? Who's opposed to limiting that? Who's opposed to requiring companies take that kind of nonsense down? I mean, we can all agree we don't want to see it, we don't want it there, and we don't want it affecting us or our children. And they're playing really to their base. They're taking, I think, a playbook not only just out of China, but in the United States, where politics are so divisive and people are so polarized that there really isn't, there really aren't many people who are undecided. And the way to win your way politically is to activate your base. And they're playing to that base. They're playing to the same base that voted for Brexit, that votes for UKIP. And they're playing to the base that's just going to take these words at face value and not unpack them in the way that we did, and not unpack them in the way that the Open Rights Group did. So if you think back to the UK IP Act now, not just a bill, the Investigatory Powers Act, I mean, there were some really scary things that that particular act now requires companies to do. I mean, like, for instance, communication service providers. They now have to retain a listing of all of the websites that people visit in the UK. If you're a communication service provider, you don't have to retain the actual pages or anything within a particular website, but a listing of websites that people visit are going to be available to law enforcement, to intelligence agencies, upon application of a warrant to a judge in the UK. That's a really scary thing to think about. You know, your entire browsing history isn't going to be available, but a listing of every single website at which date and time you visited it can be tracked and retained for at least a year in the UK. That's some pretty scary stuff. You know, that's a major regulation and a major intrusion when it comes to privacy. You know, and not to mention, if these things are going to be regulated in such a manner, there's also going to be a chilling effect on the freedom of association, what we have enshrined here in, under the First Amendment. But, you know, in the unwritten British Constitution, you know, I think it's equally applicable. And if these ideas are to be eradicated or just regulated in any way, especially when it comes to fines and possible criminal prosecution, nobody is going to want to interact with anybody who's on the fringes of society because you may become guilty of association. And, you know, this sort of bleeds into another somewhat unrelated story about the United States now requesting, as part of visa applications from certain countries, information about social media profiles, which would have the same sort of chilling effect on our freedom of association. But by definition, I would imagine that the people that are applying for these particular visas are not protected by the Constitution because they are outside the United States and they're not necessarily on U.S. soil when they're making these particular applications. So their freedom of association is frankly, you know, not our government's problem, but that doesn't mean that we should completely ignore it.
Absolutely. Voltaire. So we've got all these regulations going on, and yeah, as you said, it's noted in the Independent story regarding this, Theresa May outright refused to rule out Chinese-style internet censorship as part of her plan, suggesting that she might look to shut down or ban companies that didn't comply with her proposals. So yeah, this is all very fascinating, and as we've mentioned, the UK and England are seen as sort of a leader in the field of surveillance and all this sort of thing. So other countries will do whatever they end up doing. So it's worth keeping an eye on this, even if you're not in the UK, even if you're in the United States, because whatever they do, we won't be far behind.
You know, and this, I guess it does bear mentioning that this does seem to even extend to the regulation of pornography. Mm-hmm. As well. I mean, part of this Tory manifesto, the Conservative Party's manifesto, indicated that they wanted to sort of regulate how Google would direct people to pornographic sites. I mean, but this, again, raises another issue of how effective is this really going to be? Because companies like Google are not going to kowtow to the lowest common denominator. It would be destructive of their entire business model to do so. So if you're in the UK and you want to avoid these types of restrictions, what's the easiest thing you can do? Is to get a VPN or utilize a VPN that pops you out outside the United Kingdom where these restrictions don't take place. I mean, it seems like it's a fairly ineffective and obtrusive way of trying to regulate the internet that can be very easily defeated.
Absolutely. And it's the sort of thing that we're already kind of slipping on the slope towards because of the recent threats against net neutrality and what's going on there. There's still the site on battleforthenet.com. That's being backed by all sorts of organizations who want to fight to keep net neutrality going in this country. There's a day of action coming up, and there are all sorts of organizations that have signed on to this, not only EFF, but like Mozilla, Netflix, Reddit, just reading a couple here, Demand Progress, AVG, the antivirus company, Boing Boing, of course, FARC.com, all sorts of other sites that you use every day. Wikia, which is, of course, a wiki site, Pornhub, yes, Kickstarter, all sorts of things going on. And really it's kind of mind blowing how much of a knife edge this is all, sort of leaning on. There's all kinds of, reading to go on and, stuff. So battleforthenet.com will, keep you updated on this, by the organizations Fight for the Future, Demand Progress. You can find this all over the place. And yes, we will be keeping an eye on what happens on this day of action, which is coming up on July, what is it, the 25th? It doesn't seem to be...
July 12th.
Thank you, Voltaire. So yeah, this is something we will be keeping a close eye on and that we will remember the date of. What kinds of other stuff? We're going to take phone calls in just a little bit. But before we do that, we have a couple of listener emails. Regarding things we've talked about, Bob in Minneapolis writes to us about the Russia stuff that we were talking about last week. Bob writes, first of all, Russia is awesome, enough said. Yes, it has problems, and so does every other country. I suggest for those who have not done so, visit Russia. Moscow is wonderful. Go and see what it's like for yourself. Yes, I spent a lot of time there in another life. Excellent. As for privacy, it is not that we have something to hide. It is that we have information we want to control and keep private, i.e. sexual preference, drug and drinking problems, pregnancy, other health conditions, and certain websites we may look at late at night, none of which may be illegal, but something we want to keep private, or at least control who knows what. And I think we can all agree that we should be granted the agency to decide what details of our lives are generally available. So it's something that we definitely need to, I think, address. Another listener, Barry, writes about the Fios and copper action that we were discussing last week, where a caller had their landline phone taken away and replaced with Fios. Barry writes, they did that to a woman in her 90s on the Upper West Side last week. She thought her phone was, quote, broken, and still thinks that. She naively went to the Verizon store nearby, and they came and disconnected her copper and gave her Fios. She doesn't know what any of this means, and doesn't even have any digital devices or online devices or Wi-Fi or anything. She's stubborn and distracted, doesn't know how to care if it's copper or not, too stubborn to even get a computer. I don't want this to happen to me. How can I prevent it? My copper landline phone is indispensable and the only telephone I have. So this is a heavy question, and I don't know, what do you guys think? Is this something that people should be able to or are able to hold on to if they want to sort of resist the upgrades?
I absolutely think that they should be allowed to do this. I mean, POTS service, plain old telephone service, has been critical to, you know, our infrastructure for a really, really long time. It's the only thing that can get us communications, you know, ready communications in the event of some kind of disaster, you know, whether it's natural or unnatural. But yeah, it's a really big problem here, and Verizon just doesn't really seem to care very much about copper anymore whatsoever. Everything is a push towards Fios. Everything, you know, this is like the subscription model of businesses that is proliferating these days. They want people to sign up for Fios. They want to be able to justify to, let's say, if there is going to be a merger or some particular or some form of acquisition of even a component of Verizon, that they have X number of subscribers that pay this amount per month, and this is part of this particular component. And copper just doesn't fit in anywhere anymore. And it's very, very sad. It will eventually be entirely phased out, but there are some really adamant crusaders out there who are fighting for this, mm-hmm. Fighting to keep copper. You know, and I think I'm not sure if I should really name some names right now, but I know there are a lot of people filing lawsuits. I know there are people doing really good things when it comes to the protection of copper, and maybe this is something we can talk about again next week after we, or maybe even have some of these people on the line with us. But I think it's a really important problem, and there doesn't seem to be an easy fix to it. And it is, unfortunately, the elderly who are really suffering here.
Another reason why Verizon is so eager to switch people from copper to Fios is because, not because Fios is necessarily technically better, but because it's far less regulated. So I think if we are in a situation where we had a stronger SEC that was willing to regulate internet utilities like the phone lines with the strong regulation, we wouldn't be in this situation.
Quite so. Okay, I'd like to take some phone calls. Our call-in number is 347-335-0818 to call us here in the studio. So call in and we'll pick you up if we can. I also wanted to mention for New Jerseyites, there is a DEFCON 201 meetup this Friday at Maker Bar in Hoboken. For more info on that, you can go to defcon201.org or defcon201nj on Twitter. And talking of Twitter, how's that looking? Are folks talking to at Hacker Radio Show and pinging us there?
I was just encouraging our listeners to, if in addition to calling in, you can tweet us at Hacker Radio Show. Somebody notes that the EFF guy that we mentioned, and that was mentioned, that Rob Graham, Irada Security Post, is actually not being updated anymore, but it still has a list of printers.
Quite so. Okay, doesn't look like anything's happening on the phone switchboard. 1-347-335-0818. If you're ringing, we can't hear it, so hang up and try again.
You know, in the meantime, while we're waiting for a call here to come in, or you know, perhaps somebody to get their copper line working again in the Upper West Side before a call comes in, actually, it looks like we have a call. But I was going to say, I would love Voltaire to provide me some kind of explanation as to what the hell has been happening in Qatar over the last couple of days. But, you know, do we want to take that call? Did we lose the call?
Nope, we have the call. And,
fantastic.
We'll get back to that. But for now, good evening, caller. You're on Off the Hook.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. What's on your mind? Hello.
Yeah, hello.
Hi there. You are on the air.
Yes. Oh, no. I was just last week. I caught like the tail end of your show, and I was just wondering what happened to your old music. Why did you change your intro and outro music?
Our outro music. Thank you for asking. It changes every episode. We use something different every night. Every night, our intro is the same when we can get it working. So yeah, we play something different every night, and we like to switch things up that way. But thank you for asking.
Okay, that's it. Thank you.
Excellent. So you can get in touch with us at 347-335-0818. We still only have the one phone line, so it might ring busy or it might ring out because somebody else is on. But we can only pick up one call at a time. So if you'd like to be that one call, give us a ring or send us a note at Hacker Radio Show on Twitter. Looks like we've got another caller coming in. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hey, let me just lower my radio, please.
Please do.
How you doing?
Not bad, thank you. How are
good.
You?
Good. I'm in Brooklyn, and over here, I don't know if I don't think I've seen it in Manhattan or elsewhere. We have a new fleet of experimental MTA buses. I don't know if you've seen them. They're deep, deep blue with different decals. And the thing is that these buses have Wi-Fi technology, Wi-Fi in the bus, and they have little charging stations on the backs of the seat in front of you. So I have like two questions for you. The first question is, if you plug your phone into the charging station, how do you not know whether you've just given consent? I mean, maybe some phone information. I'm not into technology. I'm just kind of worrying out loud that maybe when you connect, you're kind of agreeing in exchange for their electricity to charge your phone. Maybe they could read some of your phone's data. I don't know if that can happen. And then the second question is, most of us have by now, we have smartphones with unlimited 4G service, at least I do, and it's pretty cheap in terms of cost. So why outfit the buses? Isn't Wi-Fi really almost a thing of the past now? Why put Wi-Fi on the buses? The expense and the upkeep and everything, when everybody pretty much has unlimited 4G, which is probably faster than Wi-Fi. So what do you think?
That's an interesting couple of questions, Voltaire.
Unfortunately, with the 4G, that's actually not becoming a thing of the past because the FCC doesn't regulate the telecom companies and force them to compete. The plans that they offer as quote unquote unlimited, their unlimited plans are extremely expensive, and they only started offering them recently. And B, they come with usage caps if you read the fine print. So anything that's data heavy, people will want to use under Wi-Fi, and a lot of people, like tourists or low income people, don't have access to that. And Wi-Fi is a lot more accommodating to them.
Quite so, and also regarding the. The power sockets. It's interesting. A lot of the newer sort of generations of smartphones, when you plug it into a computer, it will pop up a thing on your window. Would you like to allow a data connection? And you can deny that and then just use the electricity. But of course, you don't know what's going on at the operating system level if there's still data exchange going on. You can get what's entertainingly known as a USB condom. And this, what this does is it's a extension to your USB plug, which cuts off the data transmission, because there are four wires inside the USB cord, and two of them are for data transmission, two of them are just for electricity. And what this will do is block the connections of the data lines while still leaving the power lines open, and let you just use it as if you were charging off of an AC. Yes, Voltaire?
I know New York gives out New York City branded condoms, so maybe they should expand to New York City branded USB condoms.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, that's quite true. I think I'm definitely in favor of that. You know, also to go back to our caller's question, you know, what's the point of Wi-Fi? And another point of Wi-Fi here is, you know, think about what the bus companies, or I'm sorry, the MTA is doing, is they are generating their own data at that particular point. Once you connect to their Wi-Fi network, they are going to have data about where you go, what you do on the bus, you know, what browsing habits of people are in traffic, what browsing habits of people are who are on the bus for a short period of time, and if they want to begin popping up ads or selling space for advertisement, that's how they do it. So they're generating their own data set here based off of the commuters' activities while they're, you know, stuck on the bus, which we inevitably always are, because at least in my neighborhood, it is generally much faster than taking the bus to just walk.
Absolutely. And this is something that the MTA already does with the Wi-Fi they put in the subway system. Most of the subway now is outfitted for Wi-Fi. And when you sign into it, you are also being shown ads. You are also being directed towards various things that they want you to see. And so, yeah, it's I think, reasonable to expect more of the same. Thank you for that call. It looks like we've got another one here. Let's see. That does not look like we've got another one there. So, if you would like to get in on this action, you've got a few minutes left. 347-335-0818 or at Hacker Radio Show on Twitter. Let's see how this one is. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Hey, good evening, guys. Steve calling from New Jersey. I called you last week.
Hello, Steve.
Yeah, good evening, guys. Much nicer tonight than last night. It's like 20 degrees cooler with a nice breeze tonight. It's like a September night.
Absolutely. What's on your mind?
I had called you last week. My phone got shut off a week ago Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
And when I had called Verizon, it said because I didn't switch to Fios, so it's still shut off. Mm-hmm. And people say now when they call, it says a different message. It says, instead of being temporarily disconnected, it says temporarily disconnected due to upgrade something.
Wow. So you're the one who called us about this last week. And
yeah, I talked to you last week, yes.
So yeah, we talked about it a little bit. And yeah, if this is very interesting, because if they have a recording now that's also touting how this is an upgrade, then this
yeah.
is definitely... the advice that we had given you, can you remind me of that?
Well, you said maybe give the BPU, the Board of Public Utilities, a call and report it.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you
tried
that?
That's done a lot in Jersey because of older people in the farming community because, mm-hmm. you know, they've been giving us poor service. So actually, they just won a lawsuit, a couple counties like Cumberland County, Salem, Gloucester County,
mm-hmm.
because they were giving people such poor service when they had the Fios to offer because they want you to upgrade, but... There's nothing ever wrong with the copper lines, you know?
Of course.
Mm-hmm.
So this is...
wanted to give you an update
on
what's going on.
Excellent. So please continue to keep us updated of any new developments.
You could call the number mm-hmm. if you want me to give it to you off the air, and you could hear the recording yourself.
You know, I would love to hear that. Why don't you email us at OTH?
Well, I don't have any of that.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
I can give it to you off the air if you want.
I don't think we can hang around for that, but do continue to call
sure.
us up. And
I'll call you again next week and let you know what's going on.
Okay, and also if you know someone with email who would who you could get to email us with that info.
I can have any of my friends do that, sure.
Yep, that would be very cool. Our email address is widely available. It's oth@2600.com. And with that, I think I'll need to wrap things up because we're just about out of time. This has been a very interesting week, and I'm sure it's going to continue to be interesting. So for Emmanuel and Kyle out on their adventures, for Voltaire and Alex, and for me and for you and for all of us here at WBAI, have a great week. Send us email, oth@2600.com, and keep an eye on what's going on out there. For Off the Hook, this is Rob T. Firefly. Have a good night.
Hi, this is Virginia White of Earth, Wind, and Fire, and you're listening to The Sweet Spot on WBAI.
Thursday, June 15th at 10 p.m., Baby K from The Sweet Spot teams up with DJ Spinna in a tribute to the mighty force of musical ascension known as Earth, Wind, and Fire. We'll be featuring an interview we did with bassist Verdeen White and also chopping it up with Spinna as he plays some of his favorite Earth, Wind, and Fire tracks. That's The Sweet Spot, Thursday, June 15th at 10 p.m., only on WBAI 99.5 FM, listener-sponsored community radio.
Hi, I'm Ken Gale. On Tuesday, June 20th, my guest on Ecologic will be meteorologist Tom Weissmuller, who will predict this summer's weather and hurricane season and explain how El Niños and La Niñas in the Western Pacific Ocean and storms in the Western Sahara Desert will affect our weather. That's Tuesday, June 20th at 8 p.m. here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
George Orwell's classic novel, 1984, was written as a warning. Today, it's used as a playbook.
Do you believe in God, Winston? No. No. Then what is it, this principle that will defeat us? I don't know. The spirit of man. And do you consider yourself a man? Yes. If you are a man, Winston, you are the last man.
Tune in Tuesday, June 27th for an all-day 15-hour Pacifica National broadcast of our classic 1975 cover-to-cover marathon reading of 1984 on your Pacifica station. That's Tuesday, June 27th for an all-day 15-hour marathon broadcast.
Like many of you, like many Americans, I have felt frustrated and betrayed by the state of the mainstream media in this country, a media whose priorities seem out of step with their responsibilities. We need a media that strengthens democracy, not a media that strengthens the government. We need a media that enriches public discourse, not one that enriches corporations.
Hi, I'm Jane Fonda, and this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
Today is June 14th. It's Flag Day. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original Personal Computer Radio Show, and I'm Hank Key, and in the studio with me is my colleague, Joe King. We are heard each Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, on the Internet at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Our website is pcradioshow.org. Our broadcasts are available for downloading from PRN.FM, WBAI.org, and our website, pcradioshow.org. When WBAI is fundraising, we may be preempted by a replacement program, but we continue with a regularly scheduled weekly program on PRN.FM.
Well, Hank, on July 12th, we're going to have a special one-hour program with Dr. Alfred Poor and Dan Rosenbaum. He's the publisher of Health Insider, and they're going to talk about the convergence of technology and health matters. But I'd like to make note that it was on July 12th, 1957. The Surgeon General announced that cigarette smoking could kill you. Jesus, they could kill you. I wish he had said it 5 years earlier, and I never would have started smoking in the first place. Well, I got to tell you, I eventually did stop. But Hank, very often WBAI runs a fundraising drive, and they fail to pick up this show, the Personal Computer Show, from PRN-FM. Nevertheless, I'd like to tell the folks that they can always hear the Personal Computer Show, the regular weekly show, on PRN at 6 p.m. on Wednesdays. Doesn't matter what BAI does. We're always here.
Right. And, you know, one of the things that we've been, or at least I've been railing at, is that the Chromebook that came out, of, you know, about 4 or 5 years ago, the concept was good. In other words, to me, the biggest asset was if anything happens to the computer, you just do a factory reset and just bring it back to its original condition, no fuss, no muss. And one of the problems that you had, Joe, with it is that everything had to go through the cloud, and you're not a big fan of cloud computing. But you know what? For the schools, you could do, you know, that's not going to go down at all. And you could do a lot of the stuff with it. And I find that, by the way, talking to a lot of people working in corporate America, the thin client is a big deal now, where they just want to minimize the actual work done on the computer, and they're into thin clients. But the biggest problem I've had with Chrome OS, of course, is printing. And, you know, when you ask Google about it, oh, you just do cloud printing. Go to, you know, do the Google cloud printing. And I know I've once asked you, Joe, have you tried configuring it?
Well, as a matter of fact, Hank, you did ask me that, and I hadn't configured it at that point, so I went out and did just that. I configured my brother-in-law's printer for him as a Google Cloud printer. And I can think of better ways to spend a whole weekend.
Well, Google announced that they now have come up with where you can, you don't have to go to the cloud to print anymore. And I said, wow, I better look into this. And I spoke to our webmaster, Michael Horowitz, who's also into, you know, with the Chromebook, and he likes it. But, you know, as we examine it more, if you read it very carefully, I said, wait a minute now. If you want to do printing and you want to use your existing printer, is it possible? And the fine print says that it relies on that you have to have a printer IP address. And I said to myself, wait a minute, a printer IP address means a network printer. Okay, I can do that. I have a network printer. And once you have a network printer, you have the IP address. And, of course, how many people know what the IP address is? Well, there are utilities to do that. Now you're saying, now you add another level of non-simplicity. And then if you have a regular printer, I said to Michael, you know what? I could buy an adapter that take a regular printer and make it a network printer. Now you add another level to it, and I know you, Joe, said to me, that's not solving the problem.
Well, it's solving the problem, but Hank, it's a different kind of solution. I know a young woman of age 97. Hank knows her as well, and
she can do it.
I often ask him, well, with those instructions, could Irene do it? And in this case, the answer, I think, is no. First of all, Hank, you knew what an IPP was.
Mm-hmm.
You knew it was a printer protocol for the Internet, so why isn't it a PPI? The whole thing is set up for geeks. Michael Horowitz, our webmaster, wrote me a very short note about this when you told him about this, and he, three words, it's for geeks.
Well, let's put it this way. Google does not ever have a schedule for anything on things like release dates. Everything starts off as beta. You don't know when the beta becomes, you know, officially a non-beta. And I just hope that they realize that they should spend a little effort on this Chromebooks, and then the Chromebooks will take off. Because, as much as I don't believe, not that I don't believe in it, okay, but if I can do it locally, I'd rather do it locally rather than go to the cloud. It's just me. Maybe it's more than just me, but I just prefer local control instead of.
Hank, local control means your data is under your control.
Complete control.
Cloud data is open to the public. Anybody who wants it bad enough can get it.
Well, one of the things someone said to me is, well, with cloud printing, I don't have to worry about anything. And I said to her, do you know what their protocol is? And she says, what do you mean by that? I says, well,
Do you know how many versions they copy? Do they maintain a monthly copy for you? What's the retention cycle? What's involved in recovery? No, I haven't gotten to that yet, she said. And there is no set standard from company to company of what cloud computing is. That's a main issue.
In theory, if you're sending something to the cloud printer, Hank, there is no copy.
Well,
it just goes right to the printer.
Yeah. Hey,
but
Joe.
That's only theory. Mm-hmm. There might be hundreds of copies of everything you print, including your tax statements
and of course, you know what your statement is. The NSA has access to it.
What's the NSA? Do you know what they used to say? The no such agency. The NSA was so secretive you didn't even admit to it.
I tell you, with what has come out in the last 6 months about what the NSA has been doing and going to the FISA courts and just automatically, was it 1,400 applications to the FISA court and only three was turned down? I mean, it's like that's like a rubber stamp.
And the three were turned down because they had typos in them, I'll bet.
Yeah. Hey, you know, there was something that I thought was a typo, and I looked at it, and I was a little surprised by it. What happened was that I saw an article where Sharp said that, you know, Sharp Electronics, it went to court, okay, because what happened was that...
Well, what did they go to court for?
Well, they had licensed the use of the Sharp name, you know, the Sharp brand of TV, to Hisense Electric, and Hisense Electric then been coming up with their TVs with a Sharp name on it, and Sharp says, no, do not buy Sharp brand TV names anymore because all those are coming from Hisense, which they had a license, and the reason why Sharp is upset with it is because the quality of the Hisense brand TVs...
It wasn't a brand.
Well, the TVs they made is junk.
What they're really saying is the Sharp Aquos was one of the top TVs ever made, and when they stopped making TVs, and I'll ask Hank someday why they really stopped making them, there must be a story there, but they sold the name to this Chinese company, Hisense, and Hisense said, oh, with that name we can make a lot of money. All we have to do is cut all the expensive stuff out of the TV, make it a junk TV, sell it under the Sharp name, and we'll make a big profit. Hank, what'd they do? Think they were Americans?
Now, wait a minute. Legally, they can they?
Absolutely. But there might have been one clause in the contract, I didn't get to read the contract, which said that Sharp had control over the quality, which would keep them from doing that. That Sharp said to them, hey, you're making junk, and they're saying, so sue us. That's what Sharp did. They sued us.
Well, because I do know that other than Sharp, there are many manufacturers where they license the name to be used.
Also, are there any people who make TVs anymore other than the Chinese?
No, let's put it this way. There are no American TV manufacturers. What happened was that the last one was...
Sharp was Japanese anyway.
Well, the last TV maker was Sanyo. And what happened was that the Japanese had flooded the market with, you know, undersold every American product that was TV. And what happened was that they were found guilty and they were fined $200,000. And I said that was a cheap way of getting into the market.
Absolutely. It spends that much on one week's
appetizer. But Sanyo was the last manufacturer of TV in the United States, being made in the United States.
I can remember back far enough.